Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI, who is going to talk about what it is to live in an age of upheaval. Now, Alistair, what do you think it means to live in an age of upheaval? And give us an example of an age of upheaval.
Well, I think there's a lot of recent commentary out there that speaks of our time as an age that is characterized in almost unique terms by the spirit of upheaval. Words like permacrisis, polycrisis. Permacrisis was actually the Collins Dictionary Word of the Year in 2022. So it's very much a mot du jour.
Yep.
Alex Beecroft, the head of learning at Collins, described their decision to make it Word of the Year in the following terms: this reflects an ongoing state of uncertainty and worry. The permacrisis is an upheaval caused by Brexit, the pandemic, severe weather, the war in Ukraine. And actually, he continues, but I'm going to stop quoting him. Historian Asim Tooze has really gone to town on the word polycrisis, although he didn't invent it.
Yep.
Here's him explaining what polycrisis is. The shocks are disparate, but they interact so that the whole is even more overwhelming than the sum of the parts. He also said, one feels as if one is losing one's sense of reality, which I imagine isn't that difficult for academic historians. But, you know, this language has gone way beyond academic life. Mainstream foreign affairs commentators often make declarations like, you know, the age of polycrisis is here, and we just have to get used to it. This is an age of upheaval. Now, I think that this kind of commentary is actually quite presentist.
Yes, I agree.
The work of history really should remind us that the present puts a shape on our ideas, and you need to kind of modify that in light of the past. Mm. But you also need to recognise that the past is very complex and you can't easily draw historical analogy to explain what's going on.
Mm.
But claims that say our age is really special and different and here's why I'm immediately suspicious of. I think there's presentism manifests most visibly at the moment in the impulse to blacken the past in light of modern moralities. It's often used to say, you know, in light of moral advances or perceived moral advances, we're in a different world situation. You know, we're not like even the generations of 50 years ago in our attitudes, and we see the past through that lens. But I think there's also an inverse tendency, which is to blacken the present in light of the recent past. And it's really just as potent, but it's not as well understood and not as explained. And I think that's where this very, very anxious commentary that says our challenges are wholly unique gets its force.
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of that. There is this kind of dialectic going on that we're a uniquely crisis-ridden age, which is complete nonsense. Even looking back at Britain in the 1970s, and I was there, albeit rather young, it was an age of almost permanent crisis. So I can remember the 1980s was pretty much a place of permanent crisis. We went to war, for goodness sake, and that's just the UK. All ages, to a certain extent, are ages of anxiety, I think. But there seems to be a curious hysteria about crises that come. I mean, I think the most obvious example of that is Brexit, which has been seen as a unique crisis, unique to Britain. It's not at all. I mean, I just think that the measure of a polity is the way it deals with crisis. All polities, perhaps all individuals, are dealing with crisis in one way or another. It's not that one gets rid of a crisis. It's how one handles crisis. Mm. It's this existential crisis of being human. It's an existential crisis for any polity. And actually, I think one of the interesting things seeing observers from outside look at Brexit Britain is this odd myth that Britain is uniquely non-crisis ridden, that it's smooth, that it's civilised, that it's been liberal, that it was always, oh, we always thought you were so good at dealing with these things. Well, actually, no. It's often crisis-ridden. The whole of British modern political history, to a certain extent, its early modern political history, is focused on this idea of crisis. It always has crises.
Mm.
It's just become rather good at dealing with it for a lot of contingent reasons. And I think it, despite the sort of wretched state of politics in Britain, and it's hardly alone in that in the West and indeed elsewhere. Nevertheless, I think there is enough historical evidence, and indeed evidence of the present day, that it can deal with those crises and that other polities will deal with those crises.
Yeah, but I think one of the ways in which we've traditionally dealt with crises is a very robust public debate, one that is historically informed and one that is marked by eloquence, by intellectual rigour. Go back 50 years, go back to the 70s, 60s, 50s, read histories of the immediate post-war period and you're struck just about the high stakes. Britain is just about always about to go bankrupt.
Absolutely.
Politicians are grappling with problems of which our politicians couldn't dream of trying to handle this stuff. But we had an era in which people were more, I think, historically informed, in which eloquence was much more prided. It was a more deferential age in some ways, but politicians spoke in terms that were very, very rich with meaning. And they were often aware and very conscious of the full force of the meaning of the words they use, their peculiar histories in literature and their uses in kind of common parlance. I bring up Clement Attlee, as I did in the last podcast we did. Clement Attlee, when he invokes words like Commonwealth, doesn't do so with a shallow view of what Commonwealth means. He's invoking a whole history of English intellectual thought that begins with the Civil Wars and gets modified and adjusted over time. Nowadays, I think people often use words, invoke words, without being quite conscious of their peculiar histories.
And those words have to have a public resonance as well between the speaker and those who are being spoken to. So I think the most important word in English history, as soon as you brought it up and you just mentioned it, Commonwealth. Common is the single most important word in English political history, in my opinion. You have the Book of Common Prayer that offers a mythology and a religious dimension to Englishness. You have the common law, which offers a legal identity to Englishness, which is based upon, profoundly important, the idea of historical precedent. So the very legal system of England and ultimately other places has been based upon this idea of historical understanding. And that commonality is one in which everyone knows, or at least is allowed to know, the rules of the game, the abiding mythology, the focus of a political, religious and social culture. And that, to a certain extent, is what has been lost, I think, not uniquely to Britain. It's just that that word is used a lot in England and in Britain. But I think it's happened elsewhere. We live in a more vociferous world, a more fragmented world, made worse by social media, of course. The obsession with the individual we've seen in the West, a kind of form of hyper-liberalism. In this country, in Britain, you see this in both main parties, both Conservative and Labour, that they are essentially liberal parties now. We've seen that in the United States, this adoption of liberalism without any other real alternatives by which any ideology is measured. And I think that's a problem. Yeah. But anyway.
But I think why I wanted to talk about upheaval, crisis, these are just particular manifestations of that trends, that imprecision in language. And you're seeing it in the protest movements in the West where people use words like humanitarian without really adjusting it to context.
Human rights.
We've seen the shadow foreign secretary, David Lammy, write an essay on Labour's new foreign policy doctrine, progressive realism. A word salad. I mean, read the essay. It's on foreign affairs. It's full of word salads. It's full of cliches. It's full of tautologies. And I don't think that's a good thing. If we use language imprecisely, we are depriving ourselves of a richer and wiser quality of conversation. And we don't really know what politicians mean. It's very hard to work out what someone really means if they're using jargon. But I think crisis, upheaval, they're quite important words to focus on as well.
So this idea of upheaval, where does it come from in this modern sense?
So it actually comes from the field of geology, which in the first half of the 19th century was unbelievably sexy. It was a time of extraordinary innovation, of extraordinary discovery.
And a profound undermining of man's relationship with time, with the world, with creation.
Exactly. I think of the anecdote of Hugh Miller, the great Scottish geologist, who was one of the first people to really get to grips with the idea of deep time, the idea that using rocks to tell us that the world stretches back millions of years rather than just thousands of years. Yep. He spent about a year, I think, trying to adjust his conclusions about the nature of the rocks to the 7-day creation of the world in the Old Testament. Failing to do so, he then shot himself in the chest. So this was a time of very high stakes, and he died. This was a time of really high stakes. This stuff was really important. It was earth-shattering, to coin a phrase. So upheaval, the word itself, actually was popularized by Charles Lyell in the 1830s. And Lyell was a very innovative critic of the geological orthodoxies of his day. He actually spent a lot of time calling out what he described as upheaval theory, which was the notion embraced by really quite celebrated scientists like Alexander von Humboldt, that the history of the world was a story of one-off macro events of a mostly static natural order that was then subjected to repeated cataclysmic revisions. And it's actually not hard to see how theology was still playing a bit of a role there, that to see nature as essentially whole and static plays to a kind of post-theological view of the natural order. But Lyell, you know, he actually went out and observed volcanic formations. He went up Mount Etna on a mule. This is how he describes the orthodox view on how volcanoes came to be. The ancient bed of the sea was lifted up bodily. So Lyell said that people thought that volcanoes were formed in a sudden, blinding, sublime moment. They just wrenched up from the seabed. Now, with his observations in Sicily, Lyell actually said, no, volcanoes are formed in much the same way as cliffs might be sculpted out of the solid rock by the sea. The natural world for Lyell was always in flux, always becoming something new. And volcanoes, although dramatic to the human eye, were actually created out of really processes that steadily accumulated over time. So this is the worldview. History of the world was not one of magnificent rupture. It was a story of infinite creativity, constant change. And these views actually would have a very significant emotional effect on Charles Darwin.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Darwin, I mean, this concept of deep time, one of the most difficult things to really appreciate about Darwin's theory is the slowness of it, the gradualness. I mean, gradual is hardly the word. You're talking about adaptations that take place over lengths of time that are simply unimaginable to the human mind. That is, and I think this has a profound effect on history later as well. I mean, I think of Fernand Braudel and the Annales school that looks at time in different ways, the time in which we inhabit, and deeper time too, and the changes that take place, and the connection between changes that take place slowly over the long durée, and those changes that take place in the immediate measure of time. I mean, I think as well, I suppose this also affects Marx's ideas of base and superstructure as well. But yeah, it is about time, it's about change. It's a very, very difficult concept to understand. One can barely imagine how shocking it was to the Victorian mind, for example, and we know it was. And even now, it's a very, very difficult concept to look deeply. I mean, I remember one of the great popularizers of the theory was Stephen Jay Gould in his essays. And I remember reading those and just how difficult it is to take in that concept of deep time. But
yes, it makes us feel quite small.
Absolutely.
And I think it puts our upheavals, our present upheavals, in context.
Yes.
And I think a lot of our sense of upheaval is mediated through the world of images that we inhabit, and we'll get on to why that's dangerous in a bit.
So how does this idea of upheaval develop? Because you've got examples that are French.
Yes.
It seems to have had a profound effect on French culture, particularly French literature, but not just French literature, but you can come to that in a moment. I wonder if this has got something to do with the idea of revolution, because the concept of revolution changes fundamentally, I would argue, in 1789 and afterwards. Until then, revolution has been a curious one. I've always had a problem, for example, with applying the concept of revolution to what happened in Britain in the 1650s, 1640s, 1650s, simply because that is not how it would have been understood at the time. Revolution at the time was a kind of turning of the wheel. It was a slow adaptation and a return, which is very much an analogy, a metaphor that one can use about Britain in the 1640s and 1650s, where you have a monarchy, you have a turning of the wheel, and you come back with something rather like what was there before, but slightly adapted. There's wear and tear. the wheel has had to be restructured slightly, it's had to be repaired, but nevertheless there is this sense of a return. Whereas in the French Revolution, which I think we can call a revolution in the modern sense of that word, that is a rupture, an upheaval, some might say, things change profoundly. And it's interesting that it's in French culture, you argue, that upheaval is most profound and explicit, whereas I see much, much less in English literature. But anyway, just tell us.
It's interesting you bring in the political dimension. I think that's what lends French society, French history, a peculiar quality, is that although much of France remains as deeply conservative as it was two centuries ago in some ways, it also has a kind of public culture which is constantly committed to re-articulating the ideals of revolution. Go to France at election time and you can feel that very palpably. They are articulating again that journey of the nation. It's not a sense you get at British elections, frankly.
No.
And it probably never has been.
Thank God.
Exactly. But that has a kind of addictive quality. It definitely gives France some of its great charm. It also creates some of the dangerous instabilities in French culture and some of the extremes of French culture. I also think upheaval, just going back to the geology, France in the 19th century is a real centre for the study of geology and prehistory. Great scientists like Georges Cuvier and Elie de Beaumont appear, and they're actually engaged with directly in the fiction I'm going to talk about. I think you could write an essay about English literature and upheaval, but it would be more about personal upheaval in Charlotte Bronte, Hardy and Dickens, maybe less of Dickens. But it was an era of spectacular vertiginous contrast. So I think the idea of upheaval does actually pop up in lots of places. But I think in France there is that peculiar quality that trying to grapple with the legacy of revolution and of vast changes wrought in those decades while also seeing that much of society hadn't changed that much. And I think that's particularly true of one of the writers I'm going to talk about, Gustave Flaubert, in Madame Bovary, which is all about rural life and also this burgeoning Republican culture, this burgeoning world of glamour, of Frenchness, of a kind of national culture.
And personal fulfilment.
And yeah, and this promise of personal fulfilment. But, you know, we'll come to that in a bit. First off, I'm going to talk about a writer, Jules Verne, who takes on explicitly this idea of geological upheaval. And this is in his 1864 work, Journey to the Centre of the Earth. Yeah. I think most of you listeners will know the story. It's a spectacular legend of scientific progress. An expedition is mounted to go into the bowels of the earth through the crater of an extinct volcano. And the adventurers, this little troop of adventurers, there's a sort of master scientist called Otto Lidenbrock and Axel, his assistant. They're actually German, which I think was part of a commentary by Verne on the German burgeoning German scientific community. So they go into the inside of the earth and they discover things which refute real-life scientific authorities, i.e. Humphrey Davy's theory of a cooling earth, and Georges Cuvier, who I mentioned, on the correct dating of fossilised human remains. So Jules Verne is very much in dialogue with the kind of scientific authorities of his day and prodding them and complicating it and bringing that kind of magic and story into the world of science. The expedition is actually a failure. They don't reach the centre of the earth, and the inside of the earth is actually a really terrifying place. Monsters roam the deep. There are ogres and giants. And this is a world unchanged by the centuries. As you go further down and down and down, you go back further and further into time. And it's kind of been preserved there. But Verne also says that that world is kind of scary. It's purposeless. It's horrible. And ultimately, Verne believes humanity is actually better off up here in the advanced world of the 19th century with a world of material progress, of scholarly debate, of civilization. The book is itself an artifact of scholarly debate, engaging with the debates of his time. So towards the end of the novel, the travellers are actually propelled back to the surface by a volcanic eruption, by a great upheaval in the inside of the earth. And it's kind of unclear whether they themselves cause this eruption through something they've done or they're just born up in it. So upheaval actually works on several levels for Verne. There's the upheaval that the fictive journey wrecks on scientific assumptions about the origins of the earth.
Yeah.
There's a kind, you know, he's saying, maybe it's not... You know, maybe the world is not as you describe it in your scientific papers. Maybe it's a bit more mysterious. So actually, this is an upheaval that you really need to go through. You need big upheavals in kind of the past orthodoxies to propel mankind towards new knowledge. And that story of upheaval being a broadly positive thing is played out on another level. The novel is actually also a very conventional love story. Axel, the companion, is a teenage boy, and he leaves on this journey with encouragement from his kind of childhood sweetheart. You know, go on this journey. Don't be nervous. Go and become a man, and I'll marry you when you get back. He goes through various terrifying adventures, and he does come back mature and wise, and then he gets married to his childhood sweetheart. So upheaval also works on this level, although it's a pretty thin aspect of the novel. It's not why you would read the novel particularly. It shows that Verne is very interested in showing how upheaval works.
So why would you read?
Well, for the scientific progress, just the love story is not the main sort of grist novel. But what it does show is that Verne is very interested in upheaval playing out on all levels. It actually helps you prepare the way for new knowledge, new maturity, and new life. So why is he so positive about upheaval? It's because Verne was super optimistic about scientific progress. He was very much a man of his time, a man of that optimistic, prosperous age of the late 19th century. His last novel, The Mysterious Island, is a really interesting fable which speaks to man's infinite adaptability in the face of catastrophe and natural disaster. He shows a kind of group of Civil War era American castaways who are marooned on an abandoned island, and one of them, ultra positive, says when they're marooned there, "We'll make our island a little America. We'll build cities, we'll construct a railway, then we'll go and offer it to the Union." And they do. They're really successful at surviving and thriving on the island, using new technologies, using fertilizer, using coking, using... Verne basically shows how all of them, this group of castaways, use the technologies of their day to survive and thrive. So he was really convinced that we could almost surmount almost any challenge by harnessing new technology. And I think Verne would actually have been really fascinated by our era of very gung-ho private space exploration. He would have found that very amusing and sort of fun. But the point is about upheaval is Verne, again, as I just said, he was very much a man of his time, of that confidence, the kind of confident element in the late 19th century world, that world where you could see these new technologies which created those kind of vertiginous contrasts. But he also saw the positive sides of them, saying, you know, we were adapting at a very fast pace, and that in doing so we could make our world safer and more secure.
And but so what's its relation to Madame Bovary?
Well, it was published 7 years after Madame Bovary, but I don't think there's a particularly like a direct relationship at all. I mean, Verne would have been obviously massively aware of Flaubert.
But they both deal with upheaval.
Of course, and they do it in very different ways. Flaubert is constantly using geological metaphors to describe the emotions of his characters. Mm. Tectonic surfaces are really never far from the surface in Madame Bovary. This kind of brilliant rendering of one woman's journey from respectability to disaster. So just to describe the plot of Madame Bovary, Emma Bovary, she's married off young. She's from this farming world. Her dad's very keen for her to marry this doctor who turns out to be very ineffectual and kind of useless, Charles Bovary. And they shack up together in this really quite boring provincial town. And she suddenly realises that life is boring and her life is going to be rather dull. And this is a problem for various reasons that we will soon discover. Her life is really limited. It's kind of a lockdown life. She walks around her tiny garden while Charles is away on call and just takes the dog out into an adjacent field. And she just feels her life closing in on her. But this is the moment where Flaubert begins to make the novel really motor. She gets this really thrilling exposure to a new vivid world, which is quite unlike her own. She's at a country ball hosted by local aristocrats, and also these local aristocrats are some of them are visiting from Paris, and she's obsessed with going to Paris and seeing the bright lights, and so different from her rural life. And I think that comes back to that kind of tension at the heart of French society in that period. The novel's actually set in the 1830s while Flaubert's writing in the 1860s, so he's kind of taking it back a bit to a world in which memories of the Ancien Régime are still fresh, but there is this burgeoning Republican culture, this life in Paris, which is becoming this great metropolis. At this ball, life is kind of easy. There's grandeur and variety and dancing and champagne and handsome men who can dance with Emma properly and spin her round. And she's there with Charles, and Charles is just, it's a very pathetic picture, and Flaubert really kind of sticks the knife in, as only Flaubert can, really. Charles is this kind of pathetic figure, made more pathetic in light of this lovely, lovely ball. So Emma has a really nice time at this ball. And Flaubert says on her way back, this is what she feels. Her journey to Vaubyessard, which is where the ball's held, had made a hole in her life like one of those great crevices that a storm will sometimes make in one night in mountains. So this experience stimulates a really powerful set of emotions in Emma. It kind of creates a new emotional space, like a new territory scooped out from her soul. And there's a really sad irony that becomes clear as the novel progresses, that she'll never be able to fill this new territory with fulfilling pleasures. She will go out to seek romance, adventure, and she won't find something that really makes her happy. And that's her problem. That's her fatal flaw.
And why is that?
It's because her expectations of what life is are shaped by sentiment.
Mm.
And Flaubert is very critical of this word sentiment. He sort of sees Emma as guided by sentiment rather than real emotion. So there's a distinction here between real emotion and sentiment. So where does she get these sentiments? And in the opening stages of the novel, Flaubert tells us where she gets this like paper-thin world that becomes her obsession. As a teenager, she reads lots of books. She's educated in a convent, which is obviously very boring, but she gets books smuggled in. And Flaubert says these books are about love and lovers and damsels in distress and gentlemen brave as lions, as gentle as lambs. And he shows how absorbed Emma is in these books. In the dormitory, always silent, while in the distance some belated hackney cab would be rattling along the boulevards. She's just so absorbed in these adventure stories. So when her life progresses into adulthood and she gets actually married, she suddenly has this terrible psychological rupture. Her life is not what it was meant to be in her imagination. It's not fulfilling to her. And she suddenly becomes conscious, as we say, of this division, this internal division, which is made even deeper by her experiences at this ball. She can see a life out there which fulfills that romance and adventure, but she feels very far away from it. So what does she do? She goes out to kind of search for it. Her first encounter, and she does so through romance, and after her first encounter with a local landowner called Rodolphe, who is a real Egypt, Flaubert writes that Emma is in this state of delirium. She believes that the mountains have moved from their places, that there is a misty blue immensity around her, and that ordinary life was only a distant phenomenon. And that's a very important feature of Madame Bovary. It's very hard at points to distinguish between Emma's internal fantasies, this fantasy world of cheap books and sordid novels, from the earth-shattering personal realisations that Emma feels she's having through these affairs.
But the affairs are very important, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because it strikes me that I ask myself, what's the difference between a Jane Austen novel and a Flaubert novel such as Madame Bovary, his most famous work? The explicit sexuality is important. I mean, both of them deal with the idea of sentiment. Is not the upheaval in Madame Bovary, as it's perceived by both her and the reader, the introduction of an explicit sexuality that is very modern? And also, when we think about this upheaval and we look to the deeper time, we're talking about the death of God here and a religiously, deistically informed morality. Austin still believes in that deistically informed morality. It strikes me that Madame Bovary is questioning it, but can't be entirely free of it. And that's an upheaval that I would argue is linked to the geological insights of someone like a Lyell, and then, of course, the evolutionary concepts of someone like Darwin, that how do we fix ourselves morally in a world without God?
Yeah.
Austin's world is one with God. Madame Bovary is one where she doesn't really know, and that society doesn't know, because it's gone through a profound revolutionary upheaval that has ruptured belief in the deity. It's interesting that I think, and maybe this has something to do with the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism, it's much too deep to go into here, but the fact that Darwin is in a country where you actually have a religious revival during the period of his insights and the debates that happened between Huxley, his great guard dog, and everything else, his bulldog, Huxley, who fights for these ideas explicitly against vicars, against priests, against churchmen. But it doesn't actually really change the nature of that society all that much until much later. Mm. So I'm just wondering how we deal with upheaval maybe depend on the culture from which one derives.
Yes, and I think Flaubert is a very harsh novel because I think he shows that in the right circumstances it's very, very easy for people to really mess up their lives.
Yeah.
And to, just in that misreading of the significance of your experience, that essential, almost cognitive misreading of the experiences you've had, which I think Emma is constantly doing. She's constantly misreading the significance of the events she's going through. And it's very easy to go on a course to complete disaster. I think that should have real significance to us in a kind of technologically mediated age. It should really worry us because we are constantly assailed by new images, aspirational storylines, alternative lifestyles. And that's really Emma's experience. But it's
because
dialed
she's
up.
Seeing the world in snatches.
Exactly. She's not really living. And actually one of the most tragic moments of Madame Bovary is right near the end, where Charles Bovary, it's kind of Flaubert twists the knife one degree further. He sort of shows Charles Bovary reflecting that he really did love her in spite of all that, all of the things she's done. She basically destroys his life, gets him into huge debts.
Yeah.
And he actually sticks with her and tries to help her right up to the end, but he can't do so. But Flaubert is also very keen to show at various points that there are other courses of action available to Emma. She could have done otherwise at various points, and that does show that there is moral responsibility there. And I think Madame Bovary is very important reading for anyone who believes that they are quote-unquote living their truth because they've made a radical break with their past. Yeah. When we talk about how our times are unprecedented, how the extremities of our times demand revolutionary action or extreme kinds of politics, just remember how easy it is to get that bet wrong and to use upheaval as a kind of internal rhetoric to justify courses of action, which then make things actually a lot worse.
You've spoken about Jules Verne, Gustave Flaubert, and now we come to the three of your exemplars of upheaval. Probably the greatest of all of them as a literary figure, Marcel Proust. What's his relationship to these geological upheavals of thought?
I actually was inspired to write this essay by a quote from Proust. So I think that's why I'd like to end here with Proust. He called the emotions geological upheavals of thought.
Mm.
So what does he mean by that? I think what he's talking about is the ruined love affair between Baron de Charlus and Charlie Morel in the great novel series In Search of Lost Time. Now, what happens in that relationship? There's an obsession with someone who doesn't really show interest. Don't have to go into the details, but Proust is very interested in what happens to the brain, what happens to our cognitive world when we become dependent on people who we cannot control.
Mm.
All of us will be familiar with that feeling.
Yeah.
In love or in work or in relationships or anywhere, being dependent on people you can't control is a fundamental human experience, and it's also something that can be very painful when it's taken to an extreme.
Yeah.
And that can stimulate a kind of rupture in our psychological patterns, that sense of not being in control. And that's why I think he uses that geological metaphor.
Mm.
It's a kind of deep structural problem with the brain. So throughout the novel series In Search of Lost Time, Proust does portray many characters who go through almighty upheavals, and he takes us right inside their brains when they are experiencing them. He's really interested in the cognitive unworking of upheaval.
Mm.
So what happens to us when we have a profound revision in expectations, or a close friend suddenly dies, or a lover leaves forever, definitively? Proust is constantly asking, you know, what does this really do to us? How do you describe this? What are the consequences of shock in the long term? And I think for Proust, Proust has as harsh a view in his own way of human relationships as Flaubert. He is deeply unromantic. He sees a lot of the sexual impulse as a sadistic impulse. He's actually, people get Proust wrong. They think he's this novelist of florid emotion and all that. But he's very suspicious, actually, of emotions. He thinks that we, again, misread events all the time. He is actually a very acute observer of the costs of illusion, basically. Going through an upheaval puts us in a really powerful blind. We are the memory-making creature for Proust. Above all, memory is very important. And memory, for Proust, again, plays tricks. It's an ever-fertile territory for new illusion. It stimulates new desires, new wants. And Proust is constantly showing how characters have great difficulty in processing emotional material. In the first novel of the series, he portrays the narrator searching in the Bois de Boulogne in Paris for the people that made his life meaningful when he was a child. And he sees these past figures on an empty avenue, winter light prismed in the bare tree branches, these faces that are just disappeared forever. And he can't any longer distinguish between the present and the past. There's this kind of elusive merging of people and places. And Proust says, you know, remembrance of a particular moment is always a remembrance of the form of life that you inhabited when you were there. You cannot escape the past. You cannot escape the way it distorts the present. And upheavals make that especially difficult. They make us confused. They make us find it difficult to move on, to forget and find new loves. If anyone has been through a breakup and thinks they can get over it in a week, a month, they're kidding themselves. It takes years. Proust suggests it's a long process that unwinds on a kind of geological process. So that's to embrace Proust's metaphor of the emotions, a geological upheaval. And this is actually to return us to Charles Lyell's view of his criticisms of epoch theory. Even very extraordinary emotional upheavals actually play out in a kind of inexorable turning of peaks to step, of earth to rubble, bones to stone, feeling, pain, loss, merging into a kind of nothingness and forgetfulness. And I think for Proust, upheaval is this really weird process. It's not easy to deal with. And I think if we do live in an age of upheaval, it won't be clear for ages what actually really mattered and what we could do about it. And I think sometimes a little bit of silent reflection is better than making various claims about what is or what isn't wrong with our current age, because we are in the midst of it. And I think Proust is just so interested about, so what happens to the brain when we are kind of in the midst of difficult events? He's just such an acute observer of all that. But again, quite a harsh view. When people do damage to us, we kid ourselves that we can just get over it, because that damage will accumulate and shift and do damage for ages after the real events actually happen.
But there's the irony, I suppose, is that we've talked about the way in which Flaubert, Jules Verne, Proust are inspired, if that's the right word, by this new sense of geological time, this new sense of deep time, the very, very just nothingness of human existence. Yeah. And yet they are trying to place these individual lives, these non-entities, in something that's much grander, as though this is in itself a religious need that they can't just accept. It's very interesting, I think. He's often described as the English Proust, Anthony Powell, or indeed the more sulfuric version of A Dance to Music Time, that's Simon Ravenson's Oblivion, is how easy they deal with just contingency, that lives aren't placed in such importance, that in fact it's all about contingency. It's all about the minutiae of life lived in its own terms. What Proust seems to be doing, and I wonder if Joyce, who's heavily influenced by Proust, is a rejoinder to this, is almost trying to bring back that religious impulse of bringing importance to lives that aren't importance by comparing them to these deep shifts in geological time.
I think that's a very acute observation. I'm thinking about, in the same passage from which I just quoted, where Proust talks about that, when we fail to recognise, when we fail to cross that bridge from the present to the past in ways that feel fulfilling to us, when we really see that something is gone forever, that is the death of the gods. And whether it's a human face, whether it's a change of style, whether it's the arrival of the motor car, he's very worried by that in terms of changing this fabric of our lives. He says, you know, this is another manifestation in the death of feeling, the ultimate death of belief. And what we're left with is this unfolding cognitive process, this almost dry cognitive process, which may or may not lead us to kind of more fertile imagery or more vivid imagery. is a quite a pessimistic view of the capacity of relationships to redeem us, for a start.
But it's mankind's fate, isn't it? I mean, we've mentioned this before, because another modernist, T.S. Eliot, said man cannot bear too much reality. Mm. Not his greatest phrase, as Roger Scruton said, but one he used at least twice. And that is what we come to fundamentally about this, is that it's very, very difficult for human beings to deal with the fact that they are chance creations in a meaningless world. We either accept that in some way, or we present an architecture of some kind to stop us thinking about reality. And I mean, Philip Larkin is very good on this. I mean, arch pessimist, of course, but he talks about this idea, you know, these threadbare institutions and rituals that we have to remind us that we all die and there's nothing. You know, it's that's Larkin's view of the world. Of course, many people would disagree with that. But if that's the conclusion of the insights of Lyell, the insights of Darwin, then all you can see is modernism, postmodernism, everything, all the creative arts are in many ways an attempt to mask that reality through their architecture.
And
that's the
attempt.
Greatest upheaval of all. Yeah. And I think that some art deals with that perhaps better than others. Larkin, I suppose, being the classic example of confronting that in the most cold-eyed way. Yeats is quite good at that as well, actually. And of course, above all, Beckett. Beckett creates a poetry in his novels as well as in his poetry of that nothingness of laughing in the bleakness of life. And I mean, I think that's why in many ways the two great literary figures for me of the 20th century, they're not often compared together, but they're P.G. Wodehouse and Samuel Beckett, because they both relish the pointlessness of life and the sheer joy to be found in the pointlessness of life, a life that just accepts upheaval, crisis, and laughs at it. Yeah. And I think that that's, in many ways, although Wodehouse is seen as an arch conservative and worse, Beckett, a real radical, actually, they're both doing the same thing, finding beauty out of nothingness, finding beauty out of the absurdity of human life, and laughing at it. And I think that's what satirists do. The great satirists deal with the absurdity of life. And I'm afraid one of the sadnesses of this age is we have so few satirists left. Because I think there's a lack of courage in confronting. The single virtue that is absent in our culture at the moment, from politics all the way through to art, literature, administration, everything, is courage. And that is a serious problem. But maybe that's for another series. Anyway,
well, you know, I every morning, Paul, I recite to myself, I'm a chance creation in a meaningless world, and then laugh. Yeah. But I think, just to come back to Flaubert, who I think is, whenever I read Flaubert, I think, be more like Flaubert, because he just is so brutal and so intellectually demanding in terms of the rigour he asks people to live with. Mm. This kind of rigour in seeing things as they really are and taking moral responsibility. I think Emma is this wonderful character, partly because she does make the wrong decisions and she could do otherwise. She actually does have responsibility. She's not just driven along by events. She's this wonderful living character who does take decisions. And I think that call to take moral responsibility for our actions, even when we believe ourselves to be very overwrought or we believe the circumstances to be very extreme, just taking moral responsibility, which Emma doesn't really, even though she could do, I think that's a real clarion call for our time. And we're not going to get there by anxiously talking about how our crises are worse than they've ever been, no. And by bigging up that kind of intellectual commentary. It just will not get us very far and will deprive us of a bit of a richer, more courageous conversation.
No, I agree with that. And I'll finish with the words of the great seer Bob Dylan, which of course I recite as a mantra every day. It takes a lot to laugh, it takes a train to cry. Thank you, Alistair.
Thank you, Paul. You've been listening to EI Talks. The producer is Alistair Benn and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. Until next time, thanks for listening.